website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway. Mindcemetery.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we host News on the Flip Side. Come join us every Saturday night at 7 p.m. Central for our three-hour program. We have opinions on everything, and we're not afraid to share them. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can find it here with News on the Flip Side. Remember, don't be politically correct. Just be correct. Join us.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to a note of the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and as usual, we've got our little announcements to do before we get started on our program. We have a group on Facebook, and you can join us there. It's really easy to do. You just put in a request. It gets approved, usually within an hour, and bingo, you're a member of the group. You can post and comment and ask questions to your heart's content. However, it is not a good forum for asking questions during a show because I do not monitor that page during the show. You can also send me questions and comments via Twitter. Just put at Gia Scott in it and it'll pop up in my handy dandy little window and I can pass them on during the show. You can also email me at giascott@exogenynetwork.com. That's GIASCOTT at Exogeny Network, EXOGENYNETWORK.com. And that's the best ways to get in touch with me during the show with a question or comment. Now, tonight, we've also got a little announcement to make. There is a book I've written is on giveaway today, and you can get your free copy of... Now I forgot the title of the book. That's terrible, and I wrote it. Being Prepared Without Being a Kook. It is a common sense approach to emergency preparedness, and you can find it by going to bit.ly/GiaBooks, all lowercase, and you can find it there on that page. And like I said, it is free today, so go ahead and go get yourself a copy and get prepared for whatever adversity life brings you. And moving on right along from that, we've got a great guest tonight, and I'm going to let her tell you all about it. So, Janet, you want to tell the audience all about yourself?
I will. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I am here tonight because I think that you've taken a look at my blog and some of my other stuff that I'm doing online. I'm primarily a writer and a motorcycle rider, and I've created an ebook for women who want to learn how to ride motorcycles. I am a lifelong resident of Des Moines, Iowa, and I'll be about 52 years old in September, so that's a good half a century going there. I've been riding my own motorcycle since about 2002, and I've been maintaining a blog about my riding adventures since about 2004. So I'm in my 10th year of blogging, I've been writing, however, since I was about 8 years old. It's been a passion of mine for a long time. I decided some time ago that I was probably not going to be able to make a living at it, but I've continued to do it for my own pleasure and for projects like my ebook that I just created and, of course, my blog, which has been around now for quite a while, and just really enjoy doing that. And riding my motorcycle all around the state of Iowa and a few of the longer trips that we've been on, talking about our various trips and tips for riding and just all kinds of motorcycle-related stuff. So that's kind of why I'm here tonight. I'm online at bikerchicknews.com. That's my blog. I have a website for my book, so folks can take a look at my book, and that is at janetgreenbook.com. There's also, of course, a link to the book right on the top of the blog there at Biker Chick News. So I'm really happy to be here and happy to chat with you and talk about writing and writing and Iowa and all of the things. So thank you.
Yeah, Janet is one of the guests that this month I committed myself to finding all of my guests via social media. And Janet is one of the ones that I found via social media. So if you happen to be on Twitter, you can follow me. You can follow Janet as well and find out what we've got to say when we're being on Twitter. Twitter's my silly place sometimes. Sometimes it's my very serious place, but yeah.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I have been looking for guests. So for people who are interested in being a guest and are on social media, wave at me or do something to get my attention. You know, I am paying attention usually, but yeah, get my attention. And obviously Janet got my attention, and then I kind of went, well, you know, this is kind of cool because, you know, it's, as another friend of mine puts me, a case of synchronicity, that, you know, she lives in Iowa, granted a different part, but I happened to graduate from high school in Iowa. I still have a brother that lives in Iowa. And, you know, it's a state that I kind of got a soft spot for. I can even say Iowa now without my accent showing. Most people never guess
Iowa.
Iowa
accent. What is the Iowa accent?
Well, it is. There's a twang. Yeah, there is a twang. I used to hear it when I would say the word Iowa. That was the very last. I worked hard to get rid of the twang in that word because that was the only word I could not say. And I could feel it even as I said it. There would be this switch and this nasal twang would come through and it would sound so strange with the rest of my speech because it was the last word to keep that little twang to it. You know, I was probably more conscious of it than most people who have lived in Iowa. But
yeah.
I had moved to the Southwest, and none of my cousins had the same accent. In fact, I had a hard time understanding them at first, and I was a teenager, and teenagers try very hard to fit in. And the other kids interpreted my accent as me being snobbish for some reason. Why they associated it with that, I don't know. So it was a sort of a self-defense thing.
Yeah.
To get rid of it. And I was pretty good at it because linguists can usually tell to this day where you're from by listening to you talk. And I confuse them. Since I'm contrary, that's kind of fun because they can't figure it out. And that usually the most common place they tag me with is a state I've never lived in. It's New Mexico.
Huh.
So I always laugh at that because I've never lived there. Most of my family is from there, but I've never lived there. So
okay.
That's just picked up from, you know, like my mother and her siblings and whatnot. So, yeah, it's one of those little quirky things. And it wasn't that I was embarrassed about being from Iowa. It was simply, there again, teenage thing. You know, you're trying to fit in and sound like everybody else. And my accent gave me away. Now, living in Mississippi now, guess what gives me away to this day? My accent.
Your lack of a Mississippi accent.
I don't have a Mississippi accent. But I can usually tell whether somebody lives on the coast or inland in southern Mississippi. I'm not that familiar with the accents you hear further north, but because I still live in southern Mississippi. And there's a difference in somebody who lives on the coast versus one that lives even 10 miles inland, which is strange. You can hear a difference if you really pay attention. I'm not as good at it as somebody who's really studied it, because even up 20 years ago, they could usually tell what county you were from if they were familiar with the particular dialect you spoke. And I think today we're seeing the dialects less distinct because of the mobility of people moving for jobs, for mass media, because we don't hear local dialects on television like we used to, and so forth and so on. So, yeah, it is a little bit different. You know, when you're on your motorcycle, I know from reading your stuff, you love to take road trips. What's your favorite place to go to?
Well, my favorite way to enjoy my motorcycle, quite honestly, a lot of people have the bug to pack up and go on a, you know, some kind of epic journey across the country, around 50 states or 48 states or whatever. Honestly, my favorite way to enjoy my motorcycle is to get some friends together and go for a day ride somewhere around Iowa. We live in Des Moines, so we're in the central part of the state, and we are, you know, literally only a couple hours away from most every corner of the state. And what I like to really do is pick a town that has something either historic or odd or, you know, some goofy amenity, and go there and explore it and take the scenic roads to get there, have a nice lunch somewhere at a little local eatery, and then, you know, go and visit whatever it is about the town. So I've visited dozens of towns around Iowa with, you know, any number of different friends that also ride, and there are just some really neat towns around Iowa. One of my favorite ones that comes to mind is Jefferson, Iowa. In Jefferson, the big feature is an observation tower that was built there as a gift to the community from some residents who were from there. And so a group of gals and I went up there some time back, and we just took the scenic roads up to Jefferson, and we went to the top of the observation tower, and it was a beautiful day, so you could see, you know, 30 miles in all directions, and it was just very memorable. Another town called Audubon, Iowa, has a large cement statue of a bull named Albert, and Albert is there to sort of commemorate the contributions of the beef industry in Iowa, and particularly to the community of Audubon, so he's pretty neat to go and see. Just things like that. You know, so many towns around here, regardless of their size, will create or build something and then promote it, and people will come and see it. Great little town in Iowa off to our east called Brooklyn, Iowa. They have collected flags from all 50 states and several foreign nations. And so they have a very impressive display of flags in a prominent spot in their town, and we rode over there one day just to see the flags and photograph the flags, and you know, happened to also catch a really neat photograph of an old vintage gas station while we were there. You know, and neat little things happen when you're in these places. Over there in Brooklyn, I was standing there on the corner taking a picture of this old gas station that I think looked like it was from the 30s, and right up in front of me up rolls a guy driving a 54 Chevy. And it became this really neat opportunity to take a very vintage-looking picture because this person came up in their old car in front of this old gas station in this tiny town that I had never visited before. And it just, you know, to me, those are the neat kinds of things that you can capture right here in Iowa, and it's the primary reason why I love riding around the state. We have been on some pretty big trips. We've been to Sturgis a couple times, and those trips are very memorable for other reasons. But Iowa is my favorite place to ride, and, you know, for the reasons I mentioned, just the wonderful towns, the great people, the beautiful roads. It's a great state to ride in.
I know that I've had some great rides in Iowa. Sometimes they were the result of an accidental detour, sometimes a detour because of road construction. For people who are not familiar with the state of Iowa, most of it is laid out in a grid. So you know that every mile there's going to be a road. And it's literally in a grid, unless there's a river or creek that changes it. And occasionally there's a road that's been closed off or not maintained anymore. But usually everything's in a grid. It's really easy to navigate. You can't hardly get lost. So, you know, there has been times when instead of taking the designated detour, we've taken, you know, the road less traveled and traveled on gravel roads. We've seen some neat things. We came upon an Amish community, which was exciting for my daughter at the time, you know, because she hadn't seen that before, the shock corn and all that kind of stuff. What other kinds of things have we seen? And I remember as a kid going to see the West Bend Grotto. That was so cool.
We still have not ridden up there. I would like to do that. They have, you know, every spring in Iowa, the kind of kickoff to the motorcycle season is different towns having bike blessings. And the Grotto of the Redemption has a bike blessing that takes place in the middle of the afternoon. So we could actually ride up there. It's probably about a three-hour ride. We could ride up there and be there in time for the bike blessing. And that's something that we do attend bike blessings in the spring, but that is one that I haven't been to yet, and I'd really like to do that. I've been there in the car, and it's a very impressive place, and I'd love to go there on the motorcycle.
Yeah, to this day, I still have a thing about rocks, and it was probably, you know, encouraged at least by the West Bend Grotto visits. I remember neat things like a place called the Kettle. That's about all I remember about it, other than it was a peat bog, a natural peat bog in northern Iowa. And it had something to do with migratory birds and buffalo back in the day and so forth and so on, and it was a unique thing. But outside of that, you know, it was a school trip place that we went to.
I'm going to have to add that into my list. I'm not familiar with that one.
Yeah, it's someplace in Dickinson County, if I remember correctly. So it's way up there by the Iowa-Minnesota border. Because that's the area I grew up in, was that area. And, you know, of course, every summer going to Okoboji and Arnold's Park. I mean, that was like required. That was the Iowa equivalent of all the amusement parks and boardwalks and everything, you know, the smell of the cotton candy, the saltwater apples, you know, the whole bit. And it was there all summer, every day. And, of course, the Clay County Fair. That was the highlight of the fair season.
My husband and I, our family, we used to, we still own some street rods and that sort of thing. We used to travel around Iowa in our street rod. We had a 37 Chevy street rod that my husband built. And every town, you know, every town in Iowa every summer has a town festival, Sweet Corn Days or Old Settlers Days or, you know, whatever it is, some kind of days that they have. And that's, we really kind of started to discover the small towns of Iowa when we were traveling in the street rods. And it just, it's very special. The state of Iowa puts out a great book every year that's kind of a tourism book, and I'm sure every state has one of these. But one of the things I do every year early in the season is I will make a little trip out the interstate to one of the Iowa Welcome Centers where I can pick up the current year's travel book and a handful of transportation maps. And, you know, those are the tools that I use, quite honestly, to find places to go, to get ideas for rides and pick out locations and attractions and, you know, events that I want to see. And it's really a neat place to explore. We've had, you know, over time, of course, people have talked about how, oh, it's boring, it's flat, it's nothing but corn, all of that. You know, I've heard all of that. And it's not true. I mean, when I'm looking for a place to ride, one of the things I like to do is lay out my transportation map and I will look for any squiggly road on the map. You know, and I found more neat little towns to visit because of these neat little squiggly roads. You were talking about the grid a little bit ago. Some of the roads that connect the roads in the grid are the curvy roads that, as a motorcyclist, I just love. I mean, I love to be in the curves and, you know, kind of set and lean and set and lean into a curvy road. It's really a wonderful experience. And so I look for those roads on the map. There was a time a couple years ago where I had the map laid out, and I was looking, and something caught my eye down in southern Iowa, and I went, holy cow, I've got to go there. Well, it was the tiny town of Lineville, Iowa, which is right on the state line with Missouri. And so you get down there, we ride down there, and there's Lineville on the Iowa side, and then there's the little green sign that says Missouri State Line, and you step across the line, and now all of a sudden you're in South Lineville. And so it's this neat little, you know, situation that you can put yourself in where, oh, I'm in Iowa, now I'm in Missouri. I'm stepping over the line. I'm in Iowa, now I'm in Missouri. Here I can buy fireworks. Over here I can't buy fireworks. You know, it's just a really neat, you know, really neat little places like that that you find by just kind of staring at the map and going, that's a road I want to ride. You know, for me, it's just as much about the roads, the scenery, the curves, you know, the things you see and smell and feel along the way. It's just as much about that as it is about the town. So it's truly a beautiful place to ride, and I'd put it up against just about anything in terms of, you know, just colors and textures, and, you know, it's something that you notice when you're on a motorcycle that you maybe don't notice when you're whizzing past everything at 65 miles an hour in the car. There is just a great deal of texture and color in Iowa fields, you know, even in fields of corn versus soybeans versus meadow, you know, there's just so many different textures, and you know, it's beautiful no matter what shade of green. It's beautiful no matter what shade of brown, because in the spring and the fall, you know, you might be encountering different colors. But being on the bike has really taught me a lot about looking for details and just appreciating the details that you see and smell and feel that you might miss if you were, you know, if you were in your car.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, I think about road trips. Now, I have not done a motorcycle road trip of any length, okay? And I haven't even had a motorcycle license since about 1983-84, I think is when I dropped that. I am planning on getting one again this summer, much to my husband's chagrin, but, you know. But I wanted to get a motorcycle license again, and I've been thinking about getting a scooter. Simply because, you know, there again, the intimacy of being one with the environment.
Yeah.
A couple years ago, I motorized a bicycle, and that really kind of started it off, because that was the most fun thing to ride. It was far more fun than I remember motorcycles being. Because it's entirely different. I know that the first motorcycles looked like bicycles with motors. Okay, you know, I know that from looking at them. But, you know, they've come a long way since then. Today I was stopping with my daughter. She needed some parts for a motorcycle, and we stopped at a Honda dealer here in Mississippi. And I'm outside, and I'm looking through the window, and I'm thinking, these don't look anything like those old-time motorcycle pictures, you know. They've come a long ways, and they're very different compared to what they were, you know, back in the early 1900s. But the motorized bicycle was, even my son-in-law rode my motorized bike, and he's like, this is fun. And it is. You can't go very fast, okay? I mean, bikes just aren't made to go that fast. You know, they're not very heavy. They're not very strong. You don't want to stress all that lightweight stuff by going too fast. Now, there are people who race them, and they will drive them 50, 60 miles an hour. And I think that's like asking for an accident. I wouldn't do that simply because they're not engineered to go that fast.
Right.
Those lightweight frames, no, thank you.
There's a TV program, and I think I can remember the name of it, but it's one of those kind of reality shows. It's based out back east somewhere. It's the guy that owns a motorcycle museum, and he was one of the episodes of this show. He picks up every old bike, and we're talking about the really old ones from the early 1900s, you know, the 1910s, that era that you're talking about. And he picks these motorcycles from wherever he gets them. He makes them run, And there was an episode of his show where he had gone to some board track, and he was racing, he and his son and some of their competing friends and other people in his motorcycle world were racing these old bikes around this board track. And, you know, like I said, I'm going to be 52 years old. I think it looked like a blast. And it really gave me the bug, not necessarily to go on a road trip, but to find an old bike, learn how to work on it, and maybe get to ride it, you know, in some fashion like that, where you could really get the sense of, you know, a little bit of danger, a little bit of speed, a little bit of history. It was so appealing to me. And I've yet to find the bike for that project, but talk about, you know, my husband's chagrin. He's going, oh, I don't know that you really want to do this. But
yeah,
but I'd love to find something, you know, a little Honda Dream or something would be fun to find and just rebuild. I mean, those are much newer, of course, than these, but it would be fun to pick something like that and build it and ride it and really learn, you know, the ins and outs of the mechanics of the bike.
You know, I learned a whole lot about not only how bicycles work, but how the motors work in the motorizing project. And eventually, I intended to do it, you know, because you buy a kit and then you install it on your bike. I intended to do it all myself. But in the middle of the project, I got sick, so I did recruit help because it was just more than I could handle at the time, and I wanted to get it finished. And it still was an immense amount of fun. In fact, I hadn't ridden it now in a while, and I was talking, we need to get it out of the shed and you know, get the motor tuned up and running again. Mm-hmm. And because when you leave motors set like that, you know, they do tend to quit running. They may need new parts and this stuff, you know, because they're simple. Yeah, they're simple motors.
I approached the whole mechanical thing with a lot of trepidation because first of all, I'm almost completely inept with tools. I mean, I'm the only person I know who takes 15 minutes to start a bolt. You know, it's threads, it's a bolt, just do it. And I can't, you know, I can't do it. It just takes me a long time. But honestly, the most technical, I think I did change the oil on I had a Harley Sportster, an 883, several years ago. And I think I did change the oil on that with the help of my husband. But just recently, we rolled my bike out of the garage, and we were going to take the saddlebags off and put on a little backrest that I had bought for it. Because I thought, you know, if I'm going to go on any kind of trip this year, and he and I were talking about it, if I'm going to go on any kind of trip, I need a place on this bike to bungee my luggage. I don't have a back trunk. I have just a seat and the saddlebags, and I need to be able to bungee my roll bags somewhere to the back. So I'm going to put on this backrest. Well, we got to taking it apart. Didn't have a manual, didn't have any instructions. We just had the brackets and the backrest piece itself, and we thought, well, we'll take this apart and we'll figure out how to do it. So the first thing we did is we tried to unscrew the saddlebags, and of course we got both bags off, but once we did that, we discovered that there were some pieces that were kind of on the back, the inside of the fender, that started to fall off, and so these pieces are falling down, you know, through the back of the fender. And we're going, okay, this is not good. This isn't supposed to happen. Well, then one piece kind of came off, and Steve looked at it, and he said, you know, that piece was glued on at the factory. So this is not supposed to be happening. So I said, okay, clearly we don't know what we're doing here. We don't have any instructions. Let's just put it all back together. And, you know, I mean, we stopped mid-project because we knew we didn't have all the right pieces. We didn't have the directions. And it took us probably another hour just to get everything situated and put it all back together. My husband is a great mechanic. He builds everything. He has all these skills. I don't have any of these skills, and I tend to come to a project and say, hey, here's a big idea. Let's start taking it apart and do this. And then, you know, you get into it and you realize that it's just a much bigger deal than you thought. So we put it back together, and we'll have to come up with a shop manual and some other stuff before we can figure out how to put those on, but probably the most mechanical thing I've done on my bike that I have now is I put the foot pegs. I put some highway pegs on it myself. But, I mean, that was literally, you know, here's the mounting bracket, here's the thing, here's where you put the bolt in. It was pretty easy. So that's about as mechanically inclined as I really am, so I don't really know where this desire to build some kind of older bike comes from. But it sure looked like a lot of fun on that board track, so I guess that's where I'm coming from on that.
Yeah, well, you know, I can kind of, you know, relate. I'm not mechanically inclined, okay? I'm the daughter of a car dealer. as a teenager, if I had a flat tire, somebody came with a wrecker and replaced it for me. Mm-hmm. I changed my first flat tire. I knew how, in theory. I changed my first flat tire. I was nearly 30 years old. I didn't have any trouble doing it. Other than breaking the bolts loose because they'd been put on with an air hammer.
Uh-huh.
You know. But outside of that, you know, I didn't really have any trouble doing it. I've never changed the oil on anything. I've never replaced a car part. You know, when I was younger, you know, just kind of bat your eyes and somebody would surely do it, right?
And somebody would do it for you. That's right. That's exactly right.
Now that I'm older, I just plain use the pathetic routine. You know, I'm inept and I can't.
I burst into tears now as opposed to, you know, batting eyelashes and showing cleavage. I just burst into tears and somebody will come along and take pity on me.
Yeah, you know, and for me it's now complicated by the fact that I had an accident a few years ago and I have my right arm doesn't work very well. So there's like zero strength, and you know, it's prone to like spazzing out on me. And so, you know, it's kind of unreliable. Maybe it's operated and maybe it won't, you know, maybe I can hold this cup of coffee and maybe I can't. You know, and so you have
had a challenge when it comes to throttle lifting. I mean,
And I was going to put a thumb throttle on. That was why I quit riding the bike. I was going to put a thumb throttle on so that I have to twist. However, this required converting the cable to fit it, and I ran into a stumper there, and then I actually became very sick for a while. And that went on the back burner entirely. And so now it sits without a functional throttle. That was why it didn't get ridden. And so now it's like, you know, look pathetic at my son-in-law who does fool with motorcycles and four-wheelers and the like and say, can you deal with this problem for me and get it running again? And so, yeah, that's my solution this time.
There
you know, my whole thing is, you know, don't give me a pull start, anything. I have a two-cycle, you start by pedaling it. That works. I could do that. But if you give me a pull start, anything, it's hopeless. You may as well give me something made out of rock because it's not going to run for me. You know? That includes lawnmowers, blowers, anything. If it's got a pull start, it's useless to me because I can't operate it. I can't start it myself. And by the time you go through begging somebody to start it for you, they're probably just going to run it for you. So, yeah, yard tools, electric, I love, because there's no pull start.
Did someone even make lawnmowers with a pull start? That just seems like very old technology to me that we should have replaced by now.
Push mowers are still made with that pull start thing.
Okay.
And I do have a riding lawnmower that it starts with a battery. But I can only do about half the lawn with that.
Yeah.
The other half is steep slope and trees. You know, it's just not maneuverable through it.
Right.
You know, and I don't want to roll it. You know, it's pretty scary when if you try to get close to the slope part. So, you know, I'm like, no. So we need to push more. And actually, I mow it with an electric weed eater, which everybody says, how can you do that? Well, when I lived in the desert, that's the only thing I had for a weed eater. So I developed the knack of swinging it with very little stress. Now I can't do it like I did as, you know, 20 years ago, but I can still go out there and I can work for 15, 20 minutes. And you do that a couple times a day and before you know it, you're done, you know, no big deal. Other than, you know, I usually pay with, that's all I get done while I'm doing it because it does, you know, kind of get on my shoulder thing.
Right.
But, you know, that's just, you know, I can't start the push lawnmower, so that's what I do. And so, you know, that's the thing. And so when I was thinking about the motorcycle thing, I was like, I don't know about a regular motorcycle. I was thinking scooter might be more user-friendly for because of the arm thing. You know, I didn't want to do, you know, I remember shifting gears and whatnot. And I remember, you know, all that kick-starting we used to do on our bikes to get them going. And I'm not sure I want to deal with anything like that.
Yeah, kick-starting isn't really an issue anymore, but Yeah, I love scooters, and I think they're a lot of fun. Of course, I started out like a lot of people my age. I had a Honda Express moped when I was about 15, and you know its top speed was probably 40 miles an hour or whatever it was. I really loved it for the time that I had it. I never really used it as any kind of stepping stone to bigger motorcycles, but I really enjoyed it when I had it. And scooters that are out there today go, you know, they can keep up. I mean, there's some bigger machines out there.
Yeah, some of them, you know, are motorcycles with automatic transmissions.
Yes, Ridley makes made an automatic.
A lot of them, they even look more like a motorcycle than they do a scooter.
Yeah.
Now, I kind of thought the idea of a step through frame, that was attractive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You could use that even if you're wearing a skirt without, you know, because I'm tomboy enough, I wouldn't think a thing about just wearing a pair of shorts under a skirt, hiking my skirt up to swing my leg over.
Okay. Yeah, you can't really do that on the one I ride. I don't even wear shorts. I can't. I burned my leg one time riding my very first real motorcycle, wearing shorts. And I, for whatever reason, I parked the bike and I got off the bike on the high side and backed my calf right into the hot pipe, and you know, you could hear it sizzle, and I went, okay, never again.
I have vivid memories of burns, but they weren't mine. It was my little brother's.
We had a little
Honda 125 dirt bike that we rode the Dickens out of. And the thing with the neighborhood kids was, we would all get together on somebody's yard, and we would destroy their yard. We had a rotate yard, so dads didn't get all that mad. But we would put out two markers, and we'd figure eight race. See who could do it fastest. But when you're racing dirt bikes and mini bikes and whatever else you had with a motor on grass, you're going to lay them over often. And we did. We laid them over all the time.
See, I had that experience when I was in my 40s. My husband was a car dealer, and a couple of the vehicles that he brought home from the various auctions at about the same time, he brought home a little cheap kid dirt bike thing, like a dirt bike, a trail bike, and then he brought home a four-wheeler. And we had, this was my need to, you know, try to go fast and whatever I thought I was doing. But we had enough property and a great piece of property out to the back of our house that I took this dirt bike and I was just zooming around the backyard, making this loop around the backyard between the trees and over the little, you know, the little bumps in the yard and all that. It was a blast. And we took the four-wheeler and my daughter and I rode that together, just around and around in a loop, you know, around the backyard, and just had a great time on that. And this is just like you say, you know, you get the little 125 bike and you get somebody's yard and you just go tear it up a little bit. So only I was probably, I was maybe 46 or 7 years old when I did that. So.
Yeah, well, he burned his leg very, very badly. He was blistered probably from just above the knee to the ankle from repeated burns.
Wow.
And in addition, the seat, okay, this is a bike that was given to kids to ride, so it's not in the best of condition. Including the seat, that cord goes around the seat, whatever they call it. You know, the vinyl had cracked on it. And anybody who's ever ridden a bike with that cord inside that thing and it's cracked, if you're wearing shorts, it tears up your legs.
Yeah.
It's not real comfortable on the inside of your thighs. So I never wore shorts. I always did it in jeans because I didn't like that tearing up my legs.
Mm-hmm.
And he would wear shorts. And it burnt him bad because I remember it so vividly, because then he went water skiing and snapped the rope across his skis and somehow managed to snap it across those blisters and ripped them open in the water. Because I remember he was in excruciating pain.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
I remember that vividly because he must have been about 12, 13 was all. He wasn't that old. None of us were.
Wow.
And, that was excruciating when he did that. You'll probably, if he ever hears this program, he'd probably cringe at the memory even, because it had to have hurt. Because he was a kid that never fessed up to anything hurting.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. But, you know, just a few weeks ago, I was riding my granddaughter's four-wheeler. This is a very small four-wheeler, keep in mind, because she's three and she can ride it. And I was riding her four-wheeler and she was riding her dirt bike. And I was being silly and you know, acting like, you know, a crazed rider or whatever. And keep in mind that it doesn't go that fast with grandma on it.
Right.
You know, here we go. And my daughter says something about playing chicken. I soon discovered that three-year-old is a lot braver than her grandma is.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yep, grandma's the chicken. And happily confessed, cackled away. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, the bike thing is definitely bit my daughter and her daughter. And maybe it is sort of reawakening because I hadn't ridden any of that kind of stuff in years and years and years. Back in the day before I wore helmets, I had my skull fractured riding a three-wheeler.
Oh.
I was dragged by it, and I was riding with another kid. And I ended up getting dragged and didn't fall free until my skull was fractured when I was knocked out.
Oh.
And, yeah, don't recommend it. It also grated a scalp off, and, you know, it was really a gruesome thing.
The helmet lesson is another one that I learned pretty early on, and not even on a full-size motorcycle. When I had my Honda Express, and I was about 15 years old, my dad, I really wanted this thing, of course. You know, everybody was getting it, and I really wanted one. And my parents, my mother was terrified. My dad, I think, thought it was probably kind of nifty. My dad offered to help me split the cost of it. My mother insisted that I wear a helmet. So my dad went out and bought me, the moped itself was lime green. The helmet that my dad bought me was this purple metal flake glittery thing. So it was quite a spectacle. But I wore this helmet, and I had only had the Honda a couple of days, and I was riding it around the neighborhood. And, you know, I didn't really know anything about road conditions, what to look for. You know, I just knew that I was riding this thing, and it was kind of like riding a bicycle, and it was really cool. Well, I came around too fast on a corner, and there was a patch of sand, and I hit the patch of sand, and the whole, you know, the bike went out from under me and kind of skidded on down the road a little bit, and I fell on my butt there on the corner, and my head went back and hit the curb. And I just, you know, I went, okay, that's the reason for the helmet. I get it, you know, and I'm wearing it. And it was a long time before I rode my own motorcycle, but, you know, I carried that lesson, and I still, to this day, I feel absolutely naked and vulnerable if I'm not wearing my helmet. And I just, you know, many people don't. That's fine. That's their choice. But my choice is to wear the thing. It may not save my life if it comes to that, but, you know, it might prevent something fairly serious from happening. So I do, and that's where that lesson comes from. It's just, you know, experience and the feeling of not wearing it and how open and vulnerable that makes me feel. It's just, that's why I do it.
Yeah. Well, I had the lesson driven home probably about 16. That was a couple years after 16 or 17. It was a couple years after the fractured skull, but I was wearing one. I was riding with my brother, who did not have a motorcycle license, so we were in the ditch and riding a street bike, and the brake pedal hung up on a clump of dirt.
Oh.
Anyhow, it was like slamming into a brick wall. And when you're riding with your little brother, you're not hanging on very tight either. I went over his head, somersaulted over his head, and hit my head on a rock, cracked the helmet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was just the helmet that got cracked. My head was fine. That wouldn't have been true if I'd not been wearing a helmet. You know, I'd probably been dead. So, you know, after that, I will admit, I became a staunch believer in helmets. And even, well, like when my daughter was riding horse, we had the helmets.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that we never forgot them, because there were a couple of times when I'm like, oh, my God, she's going to get thrown, and she doesn't have her helmet on.
Yeah. Well, they don't, you know, they're not the most attractive accessory that one can wear, and, of course, they do terrible things to your hair, and it's just, I mean, they're not, you know, they're kind of awkward, but I don't know. That's just me. I mean, I tend to be, and that's one of the things, you know, that quite honestly I talk about a little bit in the ebook is just the whole women are more cautious about these kinds of things, I think. And that's part of where that comes from, you know, is just, I know that this is a risk and I know that, injury is a risk and while the helmet doesn't prevent me from having an accident or falling, you know, it might help me reduce the injury a bit if I do wear it. So my cautious side says, you know, my adventurous side says, let's ride the motorcycle and let's have fun. The cautious side says, okay, but let's wear the helmet. So, and like, yeah. I say, I've worn it enough now that I feel really kind of lost without it.
Well, I guess I'm home free on the worry about the helmet head thing. Whole helmet thing with me, because I have long hair, the best way to deal with it is put your hair in pigtails. I don't care if most kids quit wearing them when they're 12. I don't care if anybody thinks I'm old enough that I don't care what people think, you know.
Yeah.
I do wear my hair in pigtails because it's cool and it's out of my way and whatnot. So I wear my hair in pigtails. It stays put. And I know from doing my granddaughter's hair when she was going to be wearing a helmet that pigtails fit in a helmet very neatly. So it protects my hair, keeps it from blowing in the breeze and giving me split ends, and stays put. And I won't have a helmet head when I take it off. We used to call it hat head with hats because I worked in a lot of jobs where wearing a hat was, you know, kind of the thing. You needed the hat to keep the sun out of your eyes, but nothing else. And we always called it hat head. And there again, because I had long hair, you know, even when I did worry about what people thought, I'd put my hair in pigtails and stick the pigtails inside the hat. Nobody knew I had them, you know. Nobody would know if I even combed my hair when you're wearing a hat. And same thing with helmets, you know, really. It's just once you take it off. And unlike a hat, you can't get by going in the store with it on. You know, it really isn't that comfortable to wear when you're not on the bike.
No, certainly not. And I love it when you walk in carrying it somewhere, you know, you're carrying it in your hand and somebody says, oh, did you ride? No, I just carry the helmet around, I guess, because, you know, I want to. So,
that stupid question thing, yeah. There was a song, it was given to me years ago about stupid questions. You know, things like, you know, you tell your neighbor you're going to, you know, an uncle's funeral, and they say, oh, he died? No, we just thought we'd have the funeral.
Yeah, no, we just thought we'd do it while he's still around to enjoy it.
Yeah, you know. you do kind of get some dorky questions sometimes. But I have to ask, because I'm an avid camper, have you ever gone motorcycle camping?
No, I haven't. My husband had me convinced that we were going to do that one time. Back when I first met him and we just started hanging out together, he invited me to go on a motorcycle trip to Colorado. I was probably about 26 years old at that point and really had not been on a motorcycle at all since the moped days. So his big idea was, you know, we're going to save some money and we're going to camp. And so we went out and got sleeping bags and a tent and the whole nine yards. And just at the last moment, literally the day before we left, some money came through on a freelance project that I had been working on. And so we ditched the whole camping idea and decided that we could afford to stay in motels. So I kind of missed the opportunity, but I do enjoy camping.
You're not too old to try it out, though.
No. And that's, you know, I'm not sure I'm not past the whole tent camping phase of my life. We've done that a little bit. But yeah, I haven't done it. I mean, I know there's some neat gear. There's some neat, you know, there's a lot of conveniences and things that you can have and a lot of ways to maximize space and that sort of thing. But I haven't done it. So I don't know. We did that in the street rides. We camped, you know, we tent camp traveling in the street rides, but of course you can take a whole lot more gear in a car than you can on a bike. So,
yeah. Well, we've done a lot of road trips where we camped along the way, which, it introduces you to an area in a way that staying in a motel never does.
Uh-huh.
It really does slow you down. And it forces you to, because as we'd be going, we'd be, okay, you know, it's getting time, you know, it's in mid-afternoon, it's time to start thinking about where we're going to spend the night.
Right.
And, you know, so you start looking on the map for, you know, a campground. We preferred state and county parks simply because they usually have the lowest fees and the best facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, you start looking, and we discover all sorts of cool things that way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So it was always a fun way to explore.
See, my tent camping experience is really, like I say, they were all in the street rod world, but we went, there was one year, well, it was the year I was pregnant, we went on a street rod trip that took us to a show up in St. Paul called Back to the 50s, and then from there, we spent the week traveling across Wyoming and the Dakotas and Wyoming and down into Colorado to a show at Pueblo, Colorado. We camped at Back to the 50s, where it rained for 3 days until we were getting around to picking all the gear up to stow it in the car to start the travel part of the trip. And at that point, the sun came out. But then we kind of moteled it across, and then when we got to Pueblo, we camped in Pueblo, where it was about 100 degrees, and the camping was out in the parking lot, in the medians of the big parking
lot
there. Fairground. And so
that's
we were,
not camping. That's sleeping in
a
tent.
Yes, it was sleeping in a tent on a you know, a 6 foot wide median kind of thing. So it wasn't rustic. It was just really uncomfortable and inconvenient. But
yeah, you missed out on the fun part of tent camping. Although I'm trying out a new project, I've discovered that I'm getting old enough that sleeping on the ground isn't exactly my thing.
Right.
And I had some friends that were avid hammock campers. They talked me into trying their hammocks. I'm like, yeah, you know, that really is, it's nothing like the backyard hammock experience that I'm familiar with. This is comfortable. So I got the hammocks, and I tried it out. Well, my try it out thing, I had missed a couple of essential lessons, apparently, when I was looking at how to set it up. Anyhow, I go to get in the hammock, and it's wrapped around me, swallowed me, and then spit me out. Spit me out, yes.
I am not only inept with tools, I am also somewhat uncoordinated in general, and so that is exactly what would happen to me with this.
Well, honestly did not have anything to do with coordination in this particular case, because I'm like, okay, this is not supposed to happen. With this type of hammock, this type of setup, this is not supposed to be possible, let alone happen accidentally like this.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, check everything again, and then I cautiously approach this thing that I'm now regarding as potentially dangerous and sort of get myself in it, and swallows me again, and then it spits me out again, different angle this time. And I'm like, no way. I mean, absolutely no way. So I try a third time. Well, the third time I landed on my good arm, and there was this kind of sickening feeling, and I was like, oh, please, God, don't let me have broken the good arm. You know, I'm thinking of life with a cast, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, or maybe losing the use of that arm, you know, even for 6 weeks, it was just going to be horrible. Anyhow, I laid there for a minute as my daughter was along on the camping trip. She's like, are you okay? I said, I think so. Help me up, you know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I start working on it again, thinking, because I didn't even bring a tent on the trip. And then I'm like, okay, I'm looking at it. I'm like, I am not doing this again. So I decided the better part of valor was knowing when to quit. It's dark, it's late, and I'm tired. I went and got our Trailblazer, and I slept in the driver's seat.
There we go.
I'm getting vomited out by a hammock. So anyhow, the next day we worked on it again, and I still couldn't figure out what was wrong. And so then I used my daughter's hammock, which was the rope style, you know, with the boards in it. You know, that couldn't spit me out. Well, unfortunately, the tie-downs that we're using to support it on the trees were made of nylon. And anybody who is familiar with the properties of tie-downs and hammocks and all that, nylon straps are crappy to use for hammocks because they stretch a lot. Which, in my opinion, would make them crappy tie-downs because they would also stretch there. Anyhow, about 2 or 3 hours after I went to sleep, I woke up, and I'm now on the ground. And it was the last cold weekend that Mississippi had. Mm-hmm. And it's very cold laying on the ground. And, oh, and my dog decided she had to sleep in with me. And my dog's not a Chihuahua. My dog's about 65 pounds of elderly, large dog.
Yeah.
And she was not sleeping on the ground. She was getting in the hammock with Mom. So it was the two of us in the hammock. And, yeah. So anyhow, that was that. And I spent the second night, I just unhooked it so that I wasn't in a U-shape with my body, my torso on the ground. I was sort of flat. And I just slept on the ground the second night. And then I promptly said, okay, you know, we got to have some help with this project. So I did consult him, and I found out that I had left out, use this line to tension your hammock properly. And I hadn't put that line in there. And because it was not there, that's why I kept getting spit out. And now I'm working on stands, so I don't have to deal with the whole tree and the strap issue. So, yeah, that's a whole new ball game. But anyhow, it is time for us to go on a break. And if our handy-dandy producer has not gone into the Twilight Zone or been abducted by aliens, both of which could occur, we're going to go on break. So while we're away from your computer, check out BikerChickNews.com and see what Janet writes about there. And we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Select Other, and enter the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
The paranormal, ghosts, spirits, demons, reincarnation, past lives, the afterlife, divination, exorcisms, witchcraft, the unseen. He's psychic medium Chris George.
And he's Victor the Voice Furman.
We are Second Sight Radio. Join us live
every Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time
on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Truth is reality. The connection is you. Check out Catherine Buckley on Truth Connections Radio, Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on 107.7 FM, the Paranormal Radio Network.
Cemetery with your hosts Chip and Nicole every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Exclusively on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. We delve into UFOs, abductions, ghosts, aliens, conspiracies, and cryptozoology.
And how could you ever forget about those creepy topics you won't hear on your local news?
This is where I would insert my obligatory skeptical statement. The Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway. mindcemetery.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we host News on the Flip Side. Come join us every Saturday night at 7 p.m. Central for our 3-hour program. We have opinions on everything, and we're not afraid to share them. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can find it here with News on the Flip Side. Remember, don't be politically correct. Just be correct. Join us.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and tonight we are talking with Janet Green about motorcycles, summer road trips, and women in general, I guess. It's kind of a feminine-sided chat today. Mm-hmm. Now, when you go on these group rides, is it like women-only, girls' club kind of day? Is it mixed couples? You know, how do you do it?
Yeah, it's kind of a mixture. There's a couple different things going on. I started rides with my husband. He's the one who taught me to ride. We have friends who ride. So the group that I on my blog, I refer to my group of riding friends as the Merry Band. And anytime we just sort of get up on a Saturday and go, hey, let's go find something in Iowa to look at today, you know, I kind of send out a message that we're going to go, or maybe we've planned it a few days in advance or whatever, but it's the Merry Band who's invited. You know, it's just, it's a mixture of people, single people, couples, you know, just from many different walks of life. And so we usually end up with about maybe 6 or 7 people on their bikes, and just a mixture, men and women. More recently, in the last 3 years, there is a women's, a national women's motorcycle organization called the Chrome Divas. And I got to looking one day at that organization and realized that there was not a chapter in Des Moines. So I started one. I got some friends together and we kind of went through the process of starting a chapter. So I do have a women's group that I ride with, and we have a regular monthly chapter ride April through September, where we will, as a group, there are about 12 of us now, and as a group we will plan a ride to somewhere in Iowa, and it's a women-only group. So there's kind of a mixture, and early in my riding days, I connected up with there was a gal that worked at a Harley dealership, and she was, she had put up a flyer on the bulletin board looking for women to go on just a day ride. I'm putting together a women's ride. Let's all go. Whether you know anybody or not, just come out, we'll get together and we'll go. And that was really a neat day. That was, myself and a couple of my female friends went on that ride, and it was just a really neat day because I had never been, I had been in a large group of motorcycles, which was impressive in itself, just the sound and the look of the group. But to be in a large group of motorcycles that was all women at that point in my riding life was just almost magical. I mean, it was a great day. We had great weather. It was just that sort of sisterhood kind of thing, you know, that we are looking for. And after that, then there was another group that I went on a 3-day trip with, and that's, again, that's been several years ago as well. But that was a group of about 30 women, and we traveled through, it'd be northeastern Iowa over to Galena, Illinois, and kind of around the River Road area over there, along the Mississippi and to Galena, Illinois. And that was a great trip. That was an all women's ride that was 3 days worth of just travel and food and camaraderie and all that good kind of stuff. So Yeah, I do a little bit of both. Primarily, like I say, you know, it's my husband and I and several of our friends, men and women, but at least now once a month and occasionally as I can, you know, there's some all-ladies groups that I am part of and participate with. So enjoy both aspects of it, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I was kind of curious. I belong to a sort of loosely organized camping group called Get Ready Go. And, you know, we periodically have our campouts, and, you know, it's not like there's dues or meetings or anything like that. We have campouts.
Yeah.
We do various other activities. Right down to one day we did a taste testing of freeze-dried foods, which we discovered some of them really didn't appeal to us, and others were really, really good. Yeah, some were, like, really awful. The only thing I liked them were the flies.
Yeah,
and we discovered others that we really like. So, you know, obviously now we buy the ones that we really like instead of the ones that are on sale or whatever. But, you know, we do all sorts of things together. You know, we've had bonfires and whatnot and stuff too. So I was just curious, you know, how you did it, you know, trying to get women involved with camping. I, as a single mom, I used to take my kids camping all the time. We would do camping road trips. It was much cheaper than trying to rent motel rooms. And it was a lot of fun, too.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of women, you know, think camping is all bugs and misery. Now, granted, I'm a weird one. I knew last weekend it was going to rain all weekend, a weekend before last, I think it was. And I took my granddaughter camping in the rain. We planned this camp out in advance with our little group. Almost everybody, it was two diehards and whoever we could sucker into coming with us.
Yeah.
I was down to my 3-year-old granddaughter was the only one that thought camping with grandma in the rain was going to be fun. But, you know, he did fare a little bit better than me with who it came. And we, you know, we camped in the rain and it did. It rained almost all day, every day we were there. And that was expected. But I don't find camping in the rain to be that miserable, except when you're packing up.
See, I think my problem these days, and I'm getting better, I'm getting more in tune to it. We had, in our family, in 2008, our home was along a particular portion of the Des Moines River that flooded, and we lost our home, we lost all of our stuff, you know, so that interim between in that period where the home was not being rebuilt and we didn't know if we were going to be able to rebuild it or whatever, my husband and I basically lived in a camper in the driveway. And it just sort of took the whole, you know, that sort of nature edge off of camping. It just wasn't, you know, after about 3 months, we were, you know, for Christmas that year, we gave each other separate vacations. It just was, it was awful. And our daughter, she spent most of that summer up at her sister's home, not too far away, but there came a point where she had to come down and live in the camper because school was starting. And so then we had three of us living in the camper. And, you know, this was not even tents on the ground. This was a nice motorhome that we happened to own at the time. And it was too tiny. And we sort of became averse to the idea of camping after that for a while. It's getting better. I think we could do it again. We're starting to eyeball motorhomes and, you know, that sort of thing. But
I have to laugh as you're telling me this story. We did an experiment in micro living by using a travel trailer.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't anticipate it being as long-winded a test project as it turned out to be in the process of house hunting and whatnot. And we ended up spending, was it 2.5 years, 3 years almost? Something like that. A really long time in this travel trailer.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Two adults, 3 dogs, and 2 cats in a 30-foot travel trailer, and it wasn't pretty.
Well,
but
we
I have
very
to admit,
lucky.
You know, Greg
Go
and
ahead.
I actually got married during the time period we lived in there. And we planned on waiting until we could, you know, afford to do the thing, you know. And when we were talking, and I said, you know what, we're never going to be able to feel that we can afford the wedding. So let's just do it. So I can honestly say my goal was that we were going to do it for $200. I think we came in real close, but we had an unexpected last-minute expense. The lady who was originally going to officiate at the wedding ended up with a family emergency. Her mother ended up in the hospital in really bad condition and wasn't going to be able to be there. And we had to find another preacher at the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of, I think, sent us over our limit. But we did come in. Most people cannot say that they did a wedding for $200 or even $250, you know.
Yeah, no, that's true.
And we had a fun one. We had it at the beach. We called it a hippie wedding, told everybody to come in jeans and T-shirts, and mm-hmm. told the preacher to do so, too. But she didn't. Her husband did. He'd been at Woodstock, so he thought it was cool. We had
uh-huh.
matching tie-dyed T-shirts, and I had a rainbow veil.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah, so we did. We had a lot of fun with the wedding, which was the whole point.
Well, we didn't
do
ours at $150, but we did do ours on the cheap. I mean, I think we got by for maybe under $1,000, but we did ours in the clubhouse of an apartment complex, and we made the food ourselves. We had a DJ come and play. You know, he played recorded music for the walk in and walk out. It was very inexpensive and it was a lot of fun. It was just you know, hey, we lived together for 3 years. We're not needing a big fancy deal here, but we do want to have a party to kind of celebrate, and we approached it that way, you know, the same way. It's
the same thing with us. You know, we're ever so much than 20. Granddaughter was there with us, you know, and she had a matching shirt, just like Grandma and Grandpa's.
There we go.
Yeah, so, you know, the deal was that we had fun with it. And, you know, the whole beach wedding thing, and it was literally right on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
I did it in Hancock County, Mississippi, because they allow dogs on the beach. And one of our dogs came. I think we left the other two at home. They didn't do well with, the one didn't do well with traveling and strangers at all, and the other one didn't do well with strangers. I wasn't crazy about traveling, but the one that, she's a trooper, she's laying on the bed behind me, she's traveled all over the place with me. She's been my road trip hound, and of course she was there. And, you know, it was a fun thing, you know, but moving back towards our topic, we haven't talked mm-hmm. a whole lot about your book.
Mm-hmm.
You want to tell everybody a little bit about what your book is about and where they can find it?
I would love to. When I first started writing, my dear husband taught me to ride, and he was very patient about it. He taught me the operation of the motorcycle. He taught me the safety basics, you know, and did all this. But I was kind of looking and sort of wished that there would have been a book for me as a novice writer that was written from the perspective of a female who had come in and done this and maybe had some tips or things to think about and, you know, just approaching it from that whole calculated risk angle. And that, at that time, at least, I couldn't find it if it was out there. And so, you know, I learned from him, and I learned through practice, and I learned through my testing with the state of Iowa and all that kind of stuff. But this was really kind of a culmination of my blogging efforts. I had spent so much time writing about all the different rides and trips around Iowa and trips to Sturgis and all of that. And I kind of got to thinking one day, you know, that I would like to put something out there that was encouraging to other women who think they might want to ride, but, you know, don't really even know where to start, which questions to ask, who to ask them of, things like that, you know. So it became kind of a, let's look back on my at that time, 11 years of riding and think about all the things, all the questions that I had in my first few years and sort of put them all together into a book and, you know, try to create something that was readily available. You know, I'm impatient. I know that the real process for a writer is to submit your proposal to publishers and get, you know, offers on contracts and advances and all that kind of stuff. I really didn't want to have to deal with that. I wanted to be able to write from my perspective, what it was like to be a woman learning to ride, the issues that I faced, the pieces, the things that I went through, and just put that out there without, you know, going through and waiting and going through that whole process. So I very quickly realized that an ebook was the way to go. It was a way I could self-publish and just get it out there, you know, very quickly, and tried to approach it from a kind of a semi-humorous aspect. Some of the articles on my blog, there's some pretty good stories in there. You'll see touches of my humor throughout the blog. So the most fun that I have writing about motorcycles is when I can pull in a funny story or, you know, approach a topic with kind of a humorous bent to it and just sort of adopt that attitude. So that's the attitude that I tried to take with the book. I hope that it's helpful. It covers the whole range that you might be worried about, such as, you know, what will my parents say, what will my children say, what will my husband say, you know, kind of facing all of those various issues to what type of motorcycle should I be looking at, what gear do I need, where am I going to go, how do I find places to ride to, who do I ride with, those types of things. So it's all kind of done from a, you know, just the perspective of somebody that's done it and kind of learned it by doing, and maybe have some advice along the way for how to do it a little smarter than what I did, you know, those kinds of things. And I really enjoyed the whole process. The book is called Dead On, A Guide to Motorcycles for Women Who Think Too Much, because that is really, that's me. I overthink, I consider every possible scenario, you know, and I couch it in terms of being a calculated risk, but I really, sometimes I just flat out overthink it, and I, in my life, I have prevented myself occasionally from doing things that I really wanted to do because, you know, I thought too much about them, and I basically talked myself out of it. So this is really kind of a humorous approach for women who might be thinking or overthinking the process of learning to ride a motorcycle, and hopefully it is, you know, a somewhat humorous approach, but addressing some questions that they may actually have and helping them at least think through it, and at the end of it, if they don't decide that they want to get on and ride, they might decide, well, you know, it was worth the $3 or $4 to read the book and go, oh, I never thought of that, and now I really don't want to do it. So, you know,
it's well, it's cheaper than buying the motorcycle and discovering that's not for me.
I'm sorry?
No. It's much cheaper to buy the book than to buy the motorcycle and then discover it's not for you.
Exactly. And, you know, I try not to BS anybody. I mean, I don't pretend that I am not the expert technical rider. I can't, you know, I don't pretend to be that person. All I've tried to do is say, this is how I did it. This is how I enjoy it. This is one person's view and perspective, and hopefully it's encouraging. You know, I love to be driving down the highway in my car and see a column of motorcycles and realize it's all women. I think that's really neat. And, you know, I love to be part of the column as often as I can, but I like to just see women enjoying motorcycles. It's a spectacle, and I love to be part of it, and I want to encourage any woman who thinks that she might want or need that bit of freedom and independence, you know, to get on and learn to ride, and it's a great experience, and it's a self improvement exercise. You know, it's wonderful. So yeah, hopefully it's encouraging, and if it does convince somebody that maybe it's not for them, hey, that's fine too. So as long as they see the humor in it and they kind of take it for what it's worth, which is one person's opinion, then you know I'm happy. So.
You're talking about learning to ride and humor and everything. I'm going to tell you a little story about me learning to ride a motorcycle. My dad gets me on the motorcycle. I'm anxious to learn because my brother's already tearing around, and I think I was 14, maybe 15, right in there. And so he gets me on the motorcycle, shows me how to shift gears, where the clutch is, where the accelerator is. And then he tells me to twist the accelerator. And I didn't know that you just didn't jerk it at that point, and I did. And so then, of course, it's taking off straight ahead. And I sort of slid back, and I'm barely on, and I'm losing my balance. And, you know, he's screaming, hit the brakes. Well, in all the things he taught me, he forgot to tell me where the brakes were. I didn't know.
Uh-huh.
I had no clue where the brakes were.
The faster
the bike goes, the more I'm sliding back and pulling on the throttle again.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm heading straight for a swamp.
Oh, my God.
As he's running alongside, screaming, hit the brakes. Eventually, I grabbed one of the front brake with my hand. I don't even remember which handle it was on, but eventually I accidentally got it and stopped the bike. And I think I killed it at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, and if I was easily intimidated, that probably would have cured me of the motorcycle.
That would have stopped it in a moment. Yep. Oh, God.
But, you know, I was in a hurry, and I wanted to do it. And, of course, if your little brother's already doing it.
Well, yes. You can't be the last one to learn. That's no good.
Yeah. And my little sister did, because I was the oldest of the three of us. Mm-hmm. She learned by the whole watching thing, and we still occasionally laugh over Dad running alongside the bike screaming, hit the brake. And I don't have a clue where it is.
Well, you know, sometimes the best you can do is to be that bad example for somebody else. Kids, this is the way I did it. Don't do it the way I did it.
I remembered that lesson, you know, about him teaching me. He's not the one that taught me to drive a car, by the way. He wasn't a really good teacher. He tended to always leave out important stuff like the brakes. Tended to kind of do the same thing sometimes. I actually had my uncle teach my daughter to drive.
Yeah.
He was a very good teacher.
I was actually very lucky in that regard, because I think a lot of times what happens is a woman will try to learn to ride a motorcycle from a boyfriend or a husband or a male in her life who has possibly been riding for a really long time and has completely forgotten what it is to have to consciously think about the mechanical operation of the motorcycle while you are doing everything else, paying attention to traffic, you know, trying to be safe, looking out for hazards, all that kind of stuff. So they become impatient, you know, and they think that just because they can do all this without thinking, it should be this sort of instant second nature to you, the person who's trying to learn. And unfortunately, in a relationship like a husband and wife, that can translate into arguing and, you know, sort of picking at each other and that whole thing, and it can become quite a problem. I was very lucky. Steve had taught me when we first got married together.
He taught me how to drive a car. We'll be talking about all things geek, and from Cosmos to Game of Thrones. Nerd Reactor says, tune in if you like fun.
Sci-Fi says, tune in and replace me with Ghost Hunt and the gas, and how, you know, what would help me visualize what would be happening inside the car to make for those two things to work together to go forward. So by the time it came to learn to operate the clutch on the motorcycle, I already had kind of a vision in my head of what was supposed to be happening. So I very quickly understood the whole, you know, feather the clutch and give it some throttle and how to use the clutch. And I think that made it very easy for me to learn. And it was also probably one of the better pieces of advice that he gave me, which was not to instantly hit the brake. It was to pull in the clutch, and that way you release all the power to the motorcycle, you know. And now you can hit the brakes because you don't have power to the wheel. So it just, that was the thing that I remember the very first day that I was on the bike, and this is how brave he was. I was on the motorcycle in the driveway, straddling the bike. Got started up, you know, pulled in the clutch, started it up. He's standing in front of the bike and walking backwards. As I'm going forward, he's walking backwards in front of me down the driveway and just trusting that I'm not going to do exactly what happened to you, which is, you know, pull on the throttle and kind of get pulled back and throttle in the knee. So it just, I mean, he was very good at that. He was a very good teacher. He had some great tips. There were some things that I didn't learn right away that had I taken a safety class, I think, you know, they would have maybe drilled into us a little bit more. But, you know, I was really lucky in the way that I learned. It was a fun season. It was a fun summer because I learned early in the season, I learned how to operate the bike. And then by the end of the season, I went up to the state DOT thing and I took my test and I got my license, and it was just this really neat summer that, you know, quite honestly, it was a gift. It was a really neat time. And I was very lucky that he was as patient a person as he was at that time. So.
Now, I lucked out when I got my license. My two best friends, the three of us, went the same day. In fact, the one girl had, because you had to have a licensed bike. Mine wasn't licensed.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to be small enough because the test was so hard to pass in Iowa at the time.
Because
mm-hmm. I took the test probably in 1976 or 77. All
mm-hmm.
three of us took the test, and I was really proud of myself. I passed it the very first time. All of us did. We
mm-hmm.
practiced very hard. And we all three passed it. And a mechanic who worked for my dad and ridden motorcycles for years, it took him three tries to pass it.
Three tries. There we go. I was spooked because I went up there. Now, even at that time, you know, 12 years ago, in Iowa, you could practice the exercises and just take a test, take a written test and then a skills test. And as long as you pass both tests, you could get your license. The other option, of course, is to take the safety class, and assuming that you pass the safety class, you get your license at the end of the safety class. And it includes the same sort of skills test that I was practicing for in our driveway. Well, I had practiced, I went up and got the booklet that showed all the diagrams for all the pieces of the skills test, and we laid it all out in the driveway, and I practiced and practiced and practiced all summer long. And I got up there. Of course, the written test was really a breeze, so that was no problem. But I got up there to take the skills test, and it was me and about six guys that were all waiting. I was the only girl in the group, and the examiner said, "Who's going first?" Well, I my hand shot up. I just wasn't going to wait, I wasn't going to wait for all these other people to try to do this. So I did it, and I passed it, and I was so happy that I passed it. And I came back walked back to the group, and this guy leaned down to me, and he goes, "How many times did you have to take this test?" And I said, "Oh, this was my first try." And he said, "Oh, that's really great. It took me 10 tries just to pass the written test." And I went,
"Holy
cow."
And you were very frightened, weren't you?
Because this was a guy I did not really want to be riding alongside. If he wasn't even there yet with the basic questions on the written test, it just kind of drove home the point, you know, that people have different ways that they learn, different skill levels. Just because you have a license in your hand doesn't mean that you're a licensed or that you're a,
Well, and I know too, some people are so intimidated by tests.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That
yes.
They just absolutely, because I knew my daughter knew the material, Seven Ways to Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I turned first available time for me to get my license, I was there. I had to practically beat her to get her to go get her license. She was like 17 and a half. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, that we lived in Arizona at the time. She could have gotten it as soon as she turned 16.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd been taught to drive when she was, like, 14. She didn't even want to get her permit because she had mm-hmm. to take this test. The tests were what was intimidating her.
Yeah.
And I don't
yep.
remember if she oh, passed it the first time or not.
Yeah. Yep.
But, you know, for her it was the written test. It wasn't the fact mm-hmm. that she had to drive for the examiner. That didn't bother her. It was that written test was the boogeyman.
It was a big, bad deal. Yep. Well, I was very lucky. It took me a summer. Had I taken the safety class, it would have only taken me a weekend, you know, to go from not riding at all to being a licensed rider. But the thing in Iowa, at least at that time, was that once you passed the written test, you could legally ride on the street as long as you had a licensed motorcycle rider alongside you. And, you know, I'm not sure how that makes me a safer rider, but at the very least, what it did for me was it let me ride the bike over the summer and, you know, learn some of those traffic situations. We would go up to the high school a couple blocks away, and I would just practice in the parking lot doing the turns and the, you know, all the different turning around, right turns, left turns, figure eights, you know, all that kind of stuff that you learn how to do. And then we would go for a ride on the street after that. And we would just go up. There's a lake a few miles north of here. We would just kind of ride up around the lake and come back and make this loop. And really by the end of the summer, you know, I was doing pretty good. And I took my test My goal was I wanted to do it and have my license by the time I turned 40, by the day I turned 40. But because of that whole fear of testing thing, you know, the whole summer kind of came and went and I hadn't done it. And then it was October, and I said, okay, it's time to do this because I really do want to do this before the end of this year. And so I did it and you know, got lucky and passed it on the first try. So I made it by the time I was 40, but I was 40 in about 30 days. So not quite, you know, to the day, but.
Right.
So. Good summer, though. It was a good summer.
Well, like I said, you know, I've because I don't own a motorcycle right now, and my son-in-law's motorcycle is a large. I'm a little intimidated by this whole large thing.
Uh-huh.
I was always, you know, under the impression if I couldn't put it back upright,
and we're not afraid to share them.
It over, maybe I shouldn't ride it. There's no way I could hoist that thing. It's humongous. He rides it, you know, all the time. But a friend of mine has a small, like 175 or something. It's a really small Chinese motorcycle.
Yep.
And not much bigger than my bicycle, actually. And that's not intimidating. So I thought, well, I'll go down, I'll borrow his motorcycle and practice riding it a little bit around. Because I don't anticipate needing lots of practice, but I'm going to have to practice on that bike.
Yeah.
Before I go to take this test, and then he can ride it down to the DMV, so I can take the test.
There you go.
And
that's something,
you know,
that I do talk about a little bit in the book. There, I know of women who have started riding in their very first motorcycle, you know, with some big dream bike that they saw on the floor of the dealership, and they had to have it. And I know that, you know, they've done that and done it successfully. But my strategy is just what you're saying. It's something smaller. And work your way up. And I've worked my way up through 5 or 6 different motorcycles over the last 12 years. And, you know, to me, that was that whole calculated risk thing again. It was, I'm not going to start out on a bike that I don't feel like I can control and it's too heavy and it's too intimidating. I'm going to start out on a bike that I feel I can manage, even if it's exactly what it was, which was a little Yamaha 250 commuter bike, you know, that frankly sounded like a sewing machine when it went 50 miles an hour. I mean, that was a bike that I could manage, and that's the one I learned on. And I, you know, I kind of moved up step by step from there. And to me, that was the smart way to do it. Doesn't mean that for somebody else, you know, they couldn't manage a larger bike. I'm a short person. I think a person who is taller in stature has more, you know, maybe would be less intimidated by a larger bike just because they would have better control over it sitting still, whereas I, you know, have to find a bike that fits me, that I can be, that my feet can be flat on the ground.
Yeah, I'm not real tall either, so I'm thinking about his bike, and I'm like, you know what, if I'm sitting on the seat, I don't think I could reach the ground.
My husband has a Harley Road King, and I did pull it out of the garage the other day, and it was a little scary because, you know, he's taller than me, and he's not even flat-footed on it yet. He doesn't have it. It's new, and he doesn't have it lowered to the point yet where he's flat-footed. So I was even worse, you know, but I had to pull it out because he had just had surgery, and we needed to get the lawnmower out and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, so I had to roll the bike out of the garage. And it was a little intimidating.
Now, I have to ask another question. Having ridden bicycle as transportation, and that was without the motor on it, I encountered a lot of drivers who, beyond not seeing you, were downright awful.
Yep.
I mean, they would yell stuff at you, honk at you, pretend that they were going to run you over. At least we're hoping they were just pretending. By swerving the vehicle at you, and, you know, awful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Do you encounter this kind of problem with motorcycles?
Yes, I have. I don't feel like I've ever personally had anybody intentionally try to injure me. I have witnessed where I believe that they intentionally tried to injure my husband. And I don't understand the mindset. Number one, ride like nobody sees you, and those who do see you want to kill you. I mean, that's something that, you know, Steve drummed into my head pretty much from day one. Nobody sees you, because if anybody ever hits you as a motorcyclist, the thing that they are going to say to cover their own butt is, I didn't see the motorcycle. Well, okay, so this is the mindset. People are not looking for you. They are in a hurry. They're texting. They're talking. They don't see you. You're invisible. And so you do have to ride. You have to ride defensively for yourself, but you also have to kind of ride for everybody else. You have to anticipate somebody backing out of a driveway or somebody, this guy's coming toward me, he might turn left in front of me, you know, those kinds of things. The one that I see here in Iowa that I got to say I just really do not understand, and this happens often enough that I notice it. We'll be coming up the entrance ramp on a freeway or, you know, on a bypass or something like that, and there'll be somebody coming from behind you over your left shoulder. They'll be coming up in the right-hand lane. You're coming up on the ramp, and you're going to have to merge over into that lane that they are in. Instead of maybe slowing down a little bit, taking their foot off the gas for just a second so you can have a moment to merge into the lane, or instead of merging over themselves into the left-hand lane, they will gas it so hard so that they will come up to the point where you are at this patch of the road where you are trying to merge in, and they want to get there first. And they just don't seem to care that you are flesh and blood and that you could be run off the road and killed. You know, I don't know what they're thinking. I don't know if they actually ran you off the road and you died, would they say, she deserved it because she was on a motorcycle. I just don't understand that mindset. Take your foot off the gas for a second or move over, share the road.
That's See, here in Mississippi, they have a new one to really confuse you. You know how you're on the ramp and you're accelerating so you can merge with traffic?
Mm-hmm.
They're coming up the ramp, and instead of accelerating to merge with traffic, you know, as they're on the clover leaf and spin 25 miles an hour, they
mm-hmm.
stop.
Oh, gosh.
And, I mean, they stop. And if you're
my mother was drove some period in her life out in San Francisco where she said they knew how to drive on freeways. But apparently when they first built the freeway in Des Moines, people really didn't know how to do it. And they would come down the ramp to get on and merge left, but they would come to a complete stop at the end of the ramp because they didn't get the concept of maintaining speed. The person coming up behind you, just back off a little and let you get in. You know, I think Iowa is getting worse at that. I think, and I'm not, you know, asking for sympathy for bikers who are out there hot dogging it and, you know, tearing people off to death and doing wheelies and all that. I don't, you know, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about people who just flat out do not see you, and if they do, they make a conscious decision not to share the road with you. And it's offensive. It's insulting. And it's, you know, I'm a vehicle. I have just as much right to be on that road as you do, and please just, you know, give me the space that I'm entitled to occupy on the road and show me the courtesy that you would show to your own wife or mother or sister if she were on a motorcycle trying to get on the freeway right next to you. I mean, it's, you know, I don't understand the mindset, and I just, you know, I try very hard to give people the benefit of the doubt and believe that they truly don't see me. But they ought to be looking because motorcycles are out there, and they have been for 100 years, and, you know, you have to share the road, so.
Yeah, so people who are listening, do watch for motorcycles and bicyclists.
Yeah.
I mean, the bicycle might
Everybody,
be me, and the motorcycle might be yeah. Janet.
I always say, every year at the beginning of the biker season, I post a little graphic that I made on my Facebook page that says, you know, look out for motorcyclists so that the life you save might be mine or that of somebody you really like. You know, it's just, it's again, it's the humorous aspect of it, but it's, you know, it's the message. Just please look. You know, I don't expect to be treated with kid gloves, but, you know, I do try to ride safely. I do my part to ride safely and not be hot dogging it. But, you know, gosh, do me the same courtesy and you know, look for me and see me. And you can't miss
me.
You know?
I think a lot of it is, too. A lot of people, well, for everybody it's true, you remember the bad a lot longer than you remember the good.
Mm-hmm.
So we tend to remember that, you know, those guys on, you know, those little motorcycles where they look like they're laying on their belly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they call them, but they look funny to me, and I'm like, I couldn't ride something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
They're practically laying down, laying forward on these motorcycles, and they're always really noisy, whiny sounding. and they go whipping in through traffic, and they're doing twice the legal speed limit. Because you're doing the speed limit, and they're going around you like you're standing still. So you know they're doing double. And they're whipping between the cars, sometimes in between the lanes. You know, that's the ones that a lot of people remember as the motorcyclists.
Yep, absolutely.
Or they remember the traditional biker wearing the gang colors and the tattoos and the beard and drugs. And, you know, that's the other association.
Maybe they know somebody that got killed on a motorcycle, and so they hate motorcycles, and so they, you know, they can't separate that somehow. I know that the drivers of Iowa do not know this, but I do try to acknowledge those drivers who do share the road with me, and you know, I'll give them a wave, and they don't know what it means. But if I go by somebody that has let me in, or you know, has shared the road with me, I'll actually give them a wave of a thank you wave. And I know they probably just think I'm, you know, being a goofball or whatever, but, you know, to me it is an acknowledgement that, okay, this person valued my life at least for a half a second in theirs, and I'm more than happy to say thank you, because maybe to them that little gesture will stand out and they'll go, ah, a motorcyclist who wasn't a jerk, who appreciated the fact that I did let them in, acknowledged the fact that I let them in, and maybe motorcyclists aren't all bad after all. You know, that's a huge thing, and it's something that really needs to be sort of drilled into everybody who wants to learn to ride, and that is just assume that drivers do not see you, and you have to ride not only for your own enjoyment, but you have to ride for your own safety, and you have to anticipate what other drivers are going to do, even if they don't seem to be paying full attention.
And, you know, with the rising price of gas, which I will admit is a encouragement to me to consider the scooter routine, and it was actually part of the reason behind the motorized bicycle, is the need to get from point A to point B, but without, you know, every trip costing you $5. And at the same time, you know, when I was first talking about the scooter idea, which is not gone beyond talk at this point, I'll admit, I already decided I didn't want a little bitty scooter that topped out at 30, 35 miles an hour. And they make them. That's all the faster they go. I wanted one that was capable of getting up to at least 55, because I felt I needed that much speed because of riding. If I rode on any rural roads, I've got to have that much to protect myself.
Yep.
Which may seem a little odd, but yeah, that's the way I was seeing it. I needed to be able to at least do 55. I didn't need to go any faster than that, but 55 I felt was going to protect me from the worst, because so many roads in Mississippi, even if you're a cyclist or bicyclist or whatever, they have no shoulders.
Yep.
None. So there's no way to pull over and let somebody get on around you.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. I think you need, you know, if you're going to be out there, you need something that will at least get you up to 50 or 55. You won't ever travel on the interstate with that, but you can enjoy the back roads. You can enjoy, you know, a nice ride, particularly around Iowa. You can enjoy it at that speed or a little under, and not get too many, you know, evil stares.
Well, legally, you could ride on the interstate. In Mississippi, at least, because the minimum speed is 40.
But you'd be terrified. I mean, you know, you'd have everybody zooming past you. Because even if the speed limit is 75, you know there's people doing 85. So if you're doing 55 and you've got people zooming past you at 85, I mean, it's terrifying. It's no fun. It's no way to enjoy the motorcycle, and you know, not even a very safe way to get from point A to point B. So
I thought about that too, because there is a portion of highway that I have to take. It's a divided highway, and if I was going to go, like, say, from my house to my daughter's house, there's a divided highway we have to drive. Speed limit is 65 on this road. There are shoulders on portions of it, not all of it, but it is, you know, each lane going each direction is two lanes, so people can pass you. But traffic on this road can be incredibly fast. I was using speed control set at the legal limit, and it was pouring rain today when I was coming home. And I mean pouring. And people were passing me, including semi-trucks, like I was crawling around. And I knew I wasn't. I knew that I was going as fast as was reasonable in the rain. 65, I felt, was probably maximum speed you could drive. And, you know, our vehicle's fairly heavy. It's a Trailblazer. It's not a little lightweight thing. And, you know, some of these little cars, and I'm thinking, please don't hydroplane in front of me.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but traffic is so incredibly fast, like you said.
Yeah.
And, you know, I even worry, would 55 be enough on that road? Because I would have to travel at least, 30 miles on that road.
There's
just no option, you know, beyond going way out of your way. There's no option.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is something else to consider. How small is too small?
Yeah.
And I decided 50 cc's was definitely too small. It worked for here in town.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't work if I wanted to go fishing or if I wanted to get brave and try motorcycle camping or any of these other things that, you know, I could conceivably decide to do.
Sure.
Yeah. If I could only figure out a way to teach my dog to ride on the motorcycle, right?
There we go. I have some wonderful friends who travel with their dogs. I'm trying to convince my husband to buy a sidecar for his motorcycle because we have an English bulldog, and he would look absolutely fantastic riding the sidecar. So far, no luck on that. But I do have several friends that have found different ways to travel by motorcycle with their dogs, and it just is, it adds a really neat element to the trip. So, you know, especially
with
the dogs.
Well, I've thought about it a little bit. You know, the deal is a friend of mine had a convertible, and she used to go with us in the convertible all the time. Mm-hmm. And I can remember one day we were stopped to pay the toll to cross the bridge. At that time we lived in New Orleans. And the woman who took the money at the toll booth asked her, how did you train that dog to ride in the back of the car? And I'm like, train the dog? I didn't realize I was supposed to. I just told her to do it, you know. She's pretty biddable, and she's been trained. When she got in a car, she was not to get out until she was told to get out. And I just assumed that it extended to, because I used to drive a Jeep when she was younger. And, you know, sometimes the top was down. It never occurred to me I had to train her. She just did it, you know. And so I'm thinking, probably, I did teach her to ride in the trailer behind the bicycle, you know. And this bicycle trailer was sold to me as could be used behind a motorcycle. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah. Because she is too large to fit on the seat. I'll admit that. She's too large for that. Her butt's even wetter than mine.
There we go.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, we also have a Chihuahua. He'd be easy because, you know, you could, like, put him in a little carrier, straps on your chest, and he could ride there. But
well,
the bigger dog does a bigger challenge.
Count. Yeah, Dexter needs his own vehicle because he weighs 75 pounds, and I don't think he wouldn't ride on the back very well. But I have, you know, friends that ride with their dogs. They have special crates. They have, some of them are small enough to ride in a pack of some sort. It's really fun to have them along. And, you know, of course, they make for some fun pictures and things like that, too. But someday maybe they're in a sidecar.
Make sure you get them some doggles. Protect their eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I do have, my dog does have them. She hasn't worn them a great deal. She doesn't, this is something, it's like clothes. You have to train your dog to wear clothes.
Yeah.
First time I put a t-shirt on her, she thought she couldn't walk. Put boots on her, oh my God, her legs were broken.
Yeah.
The dog goggles, she was pretty sure she was blind. They were pretty quick to teach her not to scrape off. Hats, actually, dog hats.
Mm-hmm.
She objected to more. Yeah, she wasn't crazy about the hat.
Yeah.
But the goggles she actually adapted to. We haven't put them on her in ages because we really didn't have any reason to. She doesn't like to hang her head out the window, so, you know, unless we're crawling, and then she will. But outside of that, she didn't want her head out the window. She's truly a travel hound. She loves to go in the car. And her idea of traveling, though, is you get in the car and you go to sleep until mom slows down. When you slow down, then it's
then
time
to get
up. Then
you wake up immediately,
Now, as far as, you know, a lot of the things that women think about are going to be different than what men think about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know as a woman traveling alone and stopping to get gas and all that kind of thing, that's part of the reason that I have Red Dog is because why she traveled so well. She always went with me. You know, I can remember one time I had stopped someplace in Texas for gas, and I had gotten off in a rather iffy neighborhood, we'll just say, and I really have to have gas, so I can't drive around and try to find another exit. I have the knack of always finding the neighborhood with the bars on the windows, you know. I always find every town I get into. If I get lost, I find that neighborhood.
That's where I'm lost.
So, you know, I got to get gas. This is the gas station. And I'm pumping gas. And lo and behold, here comes your nightmare, which is a gang of boys, late teens, early 20s. This is bad news for any woman traveling alone, you know. And maybe it's stereotyping, but that's the age group and the gender that's usually going to give you grief.
Mm-hmm.
And a gang of them is always worse because then you got like mob mentality or something going on. And I'm like, oh, great, this could be bad. And, you know, lo and behold, a Red Dog leans out the window and she gives a beautiful Colgate grin. And, you know, those boys found something on the other side of the street that was immediately interesting and they had to get over there.
Found something even more interesting,
You know, I was no longer interesting, but there's a piece of paper or something over there on that fence we've got to go
check
out.
There's something on the ground over here that we have to go look at,
That's
what you call a good dog.
You know, and you know, she's done that sort of thing, you know, many, many times. She's 13 now, so she's done it a long time. And, you know, granted now I don't travel as much by myself because I'm married and everything, but, you know, she's been... she's been on many, many road trips all over the place. And on a motorcycle, you know, you're pretty vulnerable. You don't even have doors and whatnot. When you stop at a stoplight, you're right there.
Yeah.
You know, is safety something that you've had other women express concerns about at all?
You know, I really haven't, and I personally, I don't ride alone that often. Usually I'm with at least my husband, if not, you know, a group of four or five or six other people. Very occasionally I will go out and take a little trip by myself. And it does occur to me, but it's more my safety concern because I've never been harassed, I've never been accosted, I've never had anybody, you know, any sort of sketchy-looking person approach me or anything like that. I just haven't had that experience. So my worry and what sort of starts to creep into my mind is not that I'm a female necessarily, but just that I'm riding alone. And I'm very conscious. Last summer, my husband and daughter went on a trip out of town, and I did take the opportunity to go on a day-long ride by myself. I traveled actually to an Amish community here in Iowa called Drakesville. And it was about 225 miles total for the trip. And I kind of got to the point where I had started to sort of freak myself out because I was going down the highway and I was supposed to be, you know, I was thinking about this or that hazard and this or that that could go wrong. And it kind of came into my mind, you know, if something does go wrong, I'm by myself here. I have nobody to stop with me. I have nobody to help me. I hope one of these people who hates me and doesn't see me will see me laying on the side of the road and maybe stop to help. I don't know. But it wasn't so much that I was afraid of what might happen by virtue of being a woman. I was just more sort of intimidated by what could happen by virtue of the fact that I was by myself. And I had nobody else in a party, in a merry band, you know, to stop and help me and lift the bike if need be or help me with injuries if need be. And I really kind of had to consciously force myself to stop thinking about that. And I would just, you know, I started looking around at anything to distract myself from that line of thinking. It almost got to the point where it sort of ruined the first part of the day for me, and I really had to kind of fight with myself to get my mind right again and just be able to look for hazards, not panic, not, you know, because you do kind of get yourself worked up into a bit of a frenzy on things like that. And so to me, it, you know, being a woman versus being alone, I guess I've worried more about being alone than I have worried about being a woman. I do sometimes, you know, I love it when people acknowledge or notice that I'm a woman on a motorcycle, but I don't, you know, I guess visually I don't necessarily consciously call attention to that, depending on the season. I might be wearing a pink top or I might, you know, be wearing a tank top or something like that, and then, of course, it's obvious. But I don't know. I guess I just haven't had any direct experience with being intimidated because I was female. So it isn't really something that a different woman would probably answer that question differently.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. We could probably go for another hour easy, but...
I know. I love
yeah.
it.
Yeah. We had a really good time. You want to tell everybody where to find your blog again?
Welcome to
yes,
UFO Undercover
my blog
with your host,
Viper
Joe Montaldo.
MyGreenBook.com. I'm on
everyone.
Facebook
Welcome
and Twitter at Viper Chick News. So feel free to look me up. Let me know. Share some
stories.
You know, really have appreciated and enjoyed this opportunity to talk, Gio, with you and with everybody who's listening. It's been a lot of fun.
I've enjoyed it immensely as well. Well, folks, I hope that tonight's discussion has brought you more illumination for your own personal journey towards truth. With that, we are definitely out of time, and I bid you all good night. This is your host, Gia Scott, and once again, good night.